This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Anna Elliott, who's the author of a new novel called Twilight of Avalon, a novel of Tristan and Isolde. How are you, Anna?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I know this is your first book, and I have to say I found it to be a compelling read. I think you're a really good writer. But I couldn't help but ask and wonder, since there are so many books about Arthur and this period of in Avalon, what prompted you to take this on? Because it really is an ambitious thing to write another book on a subject that has been so well covered.
It has. As you say, I was always conscious that, you know, that I was writing within this larger tradition of Avalon books and books about Arthur. But at the same time, the story still felt very much own. You know, I was fairly free in my adaptation of the Tristan and Isolde legend because it felt to me that it was very important to do something new with it. You know, as you say, there have been so many adaptations and retellings of it that if you can't bring something new, you know, sort of why bother? So I felt fairly, you know, free to do what I wanted to do within the legend. And in terms of what made me take this on, it actually started with a dream, funnily enough. It's a book about sort of, you know, the sight and dreams and visions play a role, and it started for me with a dream of telling my mother that I was going to write a book about Mordred's daughter, Mordred being the great villain of the Arthurian cycle of tales. And so I woke up from this dream, and I wasn't sure whether, you know, this was divine guidance on what I was supposed to write or just a crazy idea, but I had studied the Arthurian legends a lot in college. I was an English lit major with a focus on medieval literature, so I had fallen in love with all the Arthur legends then. And this dream sort of made me go back to that and start rereading some of the legends and reading a bit more about the history and the possibility of a historical Arthur. And the more reading and research I did, the more the idea just wouldn't let me go. And that was where Twilight of Avalon came from, was that dream.
Well, that's actually really interesting to know. And of course, I think your research shows, because the historical detail is really good. It's hard, I think, even though we've read these stories so many times, it is often very difficult to keep track of who all the people are. And I think you kind of laid it out really... of course, the focus of your book is on Isolde. And
mm-hmm.
even Tristan doesn't come into the story for a really long time. And I'm not going to give away anything, because I think it's really important for readers to not... You know, we don't want to talk about things that will spoil it. And you've done, something really good in the way that you've constructed the story, so that it's not obvious what's going to happen, even though if we've read a lot of the stories, we kind of have a feeling of what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you've reconstructed it. This is not, and the other thing I guess we should say is, or maybe you can talk about, is, you know, a lot of this, the stories that we have today of Arthur are not necessarily accurate. We don't even know what accurate means in this context.
Sure. The King Arthur that we know today, and the Tristan and Isolde actually, are very much products of sort of a courtly, medieval, late 12th century sensibility. So you have the chivalry and the courtly love and the gleaming ivory towers of Camelot and knights in shining armor. And if there was a historical Arthur, his world was so far removed from that. Historians think that, you know, we don't know whether there really was a historical Arthur, but if there was, he would have been a warlord who led a potentially successful resistance against the invading Saxons in the late 5th to early 6th century AD. So This is a very sort of brutal and dark era of Britain's history, very, very far removed from the, you know, the chivalric Arthur that we think of today.
Right. No, I think that's really, that was important to me. The you didn't shy away from some of the really terrible things. I mean, that clearly, as told from a woman's point of view, at a time when men were particularly brutal, both amongst themselves and toward women who were treated, obviously, as chattel, you know, Isolde has to stand up as a woman in a time when that was virtually impossible to do.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, you know, and you, as you portray her, you know, she has to navigate some very difficult circumstances with some very powerful and brutal and kind of almost without morals kings and you know, and others who could take advantage of her in an instant.
Yeah, she definitely does, and that was one of the things that I found both very difficult to write about. Of course, as a woman, it's very difficult to sort of watch your heroine going through all this and trying to navigate this brutal world in which, as you say, she has very little concrete power. And yet it was really inspiring to me to watch her. You know, I got very close to her as a character throughout the course of, well, it's three books that I've been with her now. I just finished the third book of the trilogy. So, you know, I've gotten very close to her, and it's been very inspiring to watch her, you know, be heroic and take command and sort of take charge of her own destiny, even within a world and a power structure that really is not set up to allow her to do that, but she's able to do it anyway. And I found it really inspiring to watch her.
Well, she's, you know, as you have her, I think she is a, and of course it's always tricky because you don't want to modernize the character as placed in the historical period. I think the thing that drives at least a lot of readers crazy, including me, is you know, when a book is not sufficiently of its period and the modern sensibility is too strongly introduced, and I don't think you did that, so...
Well, thank you. Yeah, I did try not to. You know, you don't want 20th century characters in period dress, kind of, you know?
Right, exactly, or even 13th or 14th century characters, and I think that was, that, you know, that stuck with me, that you're portraying a period which is much earlier than the kind of fanciful, sentimentalized Arthur period. And of course, there the other thing that I thought, I mean, I don't want to, again, there are things I don't want to give away, but things happen to the characters that are very painful and, you know, sad, and you know, you just feel for them. You know, it's not all successful and glittering and, you know, this sort of Disney version of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and there are things that I thought were important. You know, I think it's, you know, historical fiction is not just to enter someone else's period. If, you know, fiction, if it's going to be a work of art, has to help, you know, transform our experiences and help us, you know, envision ourselves in a different way.
Absolutely. I always think when I was writing it, as you say, there are things that are very painful and very difficult for me to write, and I'm sure to read as well. I've had many people say, like, oh, this part was, you know, really sad or whatever. But my hope was that, you know, the story would end sort of with a feeling of hope that even though, even in the darkest periods of history, even at the, you know, the most brutal times, the human spirit can sort of transcend that and be triumphant, and so that there would be hope at the end, even though these things are so painful that we have to go through.
Well, and I think that's, you know, that is the documentation of human history. We go through periods where things are bad, but then, you know, then, you know, we overcome. And
yeah.
That's the constant. But things are difficult. And the other thing, of course, is that, you know, at times like the period you're talking about, it was a difficult time. You know, you have a story of the plague taking place during this period, you know, when lots of people died and they didn't really have any way of curing them or healing people. And you have injuries, you know, battle wounds that are pretty incredible. And you talk about, you know, I don't think, you know, that's sort of, that's a, it is kind of funny because, of course, we have battle wounds today, and they're just as horrific, if not worse.
Yeah.
But
that was actually, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because my Isolde is a healer. So she's a combat nurse, effectively. She's treating all these wounded men who are wounded in the constant battles and warfare that went on at that time. And so when I was doing the research, you mentioned we still have that today. I actually read a lot of accounts of combat nurses from World War II up through Vietnam and in Iraq, and watched documentaries about medical stations in Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan, and sort of listened to the experiences of the doctors and nurses who were treating these men, and to the wounded men themselves, what did they have to say about their experiences? Because I think that even though, as you say, that world is so far removed from ours, the human emotion behind those kind of injuries and behind those kind of situations is really a constant. So that was really powerful for me to look at how similar it was, even though it's so different today, how similar the human emotion is.
Right, and I picked up on that. I thought that was pretty interesting. And of course, we don't have healing battle wounds with maggots as much as we as they did. Although I really like that character, by the way, the Ector.
Oh, he is so much fun. I just had a great time writing him. He's a grumpy old man, and I don't know, somehow the grumpy ones they're really fun to write. You can sort of let out all your hidden frustrations or whatever,
right,
and let them speak for you if you're having a bad day or whatever.
You can't have all of the characters be so serious and involved in the matters of the big matters of state. You have to have the people who are also, you know, involved in other levels and who are, you know, the kind of foil to the seriousness.
Sure,
I think it was interesting also to me that, you know, I read the book pretty much, you know, without many interruptions. I was able to put some time into reading, and the story was, carried me along without any, you know, any real resistance on my part, which I thought was a good sign.
Thank you. It's always really nice to hear.
But at the, you know, of course, at the end, as in a good trilogy, you left us at a point where we really want to know what happens next. And so I'm curious about the next book, even though I know this first book is just really just new.
The first book came out in May, and the next book will be out this coming May. The second book is Dark Moon of Avalon, and it's the first book sort of set up Isolde's inner journey. I thought of it as very much Isolde's book, I guess. It's really about her and about her background and her struggles and where she is at the beginning of this trilogy. And the second book is much more Tristan and Isolde, both of them. They sort of share this book very much. The first one is almost exclusively from Isolde's point of view. And the second one alternates between Isolde and Tristan. And if you're familiar at all with the legends, Isolde and Tristan take a boat voyage in the legends, and that's where they drink the fateful magic potion that makes them fall in love. And I don't have a magic potion in my books, but this is, you know, sort of the second book is sort of that segment of the legend. It's the part where they really deepen their relationship and fall in love, and Isolde is able to sort of work past all the trauma that happened to her in book one, and she's moving towards sort of a healing of the spirit with her relationship with Tristan. So book two was really fun for me to write in that sense. I really enjoyed it.
And you mentioned earlier you finished book three as well now.
That's right. Yeah. Book three. I just finished in August, right before my second daughter was born. I was racing to finish it before I had the second baby. So just got it done. And it's sort of sad for me to be done with Tristan and Isolde. You know, they've been with me for 4 years now that I've been working on this trilogy. But it's really nice. It's a nice sense of completion, and I was, really happy. I actually wrote the very last scene of the third book was the first thing I wrote before I even started working on book one. I wrote the very ending of the whole trilogy. So it was really a nice sense of fulfillment to get to that scene and to get to write it for real
So
and to have.
did you map out? I mean, this is sort of an interesting thing with three different books and an ending that you knew. Did you build a map of how you were going to get there, or did you just, did it evolve as you went through the writing of the three books?
A little bit of both, I would say. I'm sort of a compulsive planner in terms of my writing process. There are many people who are, yes, you call them seat of the pantsers, so who just start writing and see where it takes them. And I'm much more of kind of a control freak writer. I need to have a plan, and I need a pretty detailed outline. I do let myself sort of be a bit free within that outline if things need to change as I'm writing, if something that I outline just isn't going to work when I get to the actual writing of it. I let myself change pretty freely, but I do need a plan. So, yeah, I did have the three books basically mapped out, the sort of beginning, middle, and end of each book mapped out before I started writing book one. I think it helps when you're writing a trilogy to have a plan, because if you make storytelling choices in the first book that you regret in the third book, if you didn't have a plan, you could sort of get yourself into a bit of trouble that way.
Yeah, I
So
would imagine. I think, yeah, it's pretty ambitious to write three books without a plan. I don't think it could be done. Well, maybe somebody could do it, but
yeah, not me, that's for sure.
but and then how do you do this when you have small children? I think that's also a pretty amazing idea that you are able to. How old's your first daughter?
She is two. She's turning 3 this year.
So
So,
you
yeah.
obviously were writing
I
during that
was. I
time.
was. I was expecting her. I was 4 months pregnant with her when I had the dream about writing a book about Mordred's daughter. And then, so I was writing it after. Well, I think I was a third of the way done with the first draft when she was born, and then finished it when she was maybe 9 months old. And landed my agent shortly thereafter, and then we sold it the week before her first birthday. So, yeah, it's kind of all I've ever known is combining little kids with writing. It's just how it's been for me. So I don't really know anything different, but it's definitely a juggling act. I'm lucky in that my husband's a grad student, so he's able to work from home a good bit, and his schedule is flexible. So we kind of do a lot of tag team parenting, and if I think I love writing so much, and I loved Tristan and his old story so much that I just had to tell it. And when you just have a story that you absolutely have to tell, you just find the time, no matter what else you have going on in your life. There's always, that hour or two a day when you just carve it out because the story is just, screaming at you to get it down onto the page.
Well, although it takes a certain kind of person to be able to maintain that commitment for such a long period of time. I don't think just anybody can do that, obviously.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I've learned to be pretty good at self-discipline and being organized and everything. But I think it also comes down to just loving my characters so much. I mean, they were with me for 4 years, and as I said, I wrote the last scene where I knew I wanted them to end up at the very end of this trilogy. I had that in my head first, so I just couldn't give up on them before I'd gotten them to that ending that I'd imagined for them. It's like they're I don't want to say that they're like real people to me. That strikes me as it's kind of a cliche. They're, obviously they're fictional characters, but I still just couldn't leave them before they got to the end of their story that I'd imagined. So
Well, no, that I think that's important for, every writer is different, I think, in how he or she deals with that. But so, I mean, the other question, of course, is when now that you're done with those three books, are you done with those characters? What's next? Do you go back and explore some other area of that period, or are you going to go on and try to wait for the next thing to emerge?
yeah, well, I just had a meeting with my agent about what the next thing is. So yeah, I think I'm done. I mean, I'm done with Tristan and Isolde. I got them I love them and I love spending these 4 years with them, but you know, there comes a point when they've reached the end of their story that it's my job to tell. You know, you sort of release them into the world and you know, have to let them go at that point. So I think I'm done with them. I might go back to the Arthurian tales at some point because I do love the Arthur legends and the Arthurian world.
I would love to see you do something with Morgan. I think I always feel like Morgan has more. There's more to tell.
I loved Morgan. Narrates the prologues of all three books, and then she narrates the afterword of book three. And I loved writing her. I love her as a character, and she's one of the characters that really talked to me the most clearly and the most insistently when I was writing it. She speaks in the first person to me, which the other characters were all in third person point of view, but Morgan was very insistent that she was going to tell her own story in the first person, and so I could see going back to her maybe. For right now, I'm actually working on something completely different, set in Victorian London. This is just an idea that sort of popped into my head right after my second daughter was born a couple of months ago, and spoke to my agent about it, and I'm sworn on pain of death not to reveal too much because we haven't even sold the idea yet. But it's just a complete departure from Tristan and Isolde. So we'll see where that goes. And then I have another couple of Dark Age legends, not Arthurian legends, but Dark Age Celtic stories that I have sort of in outline form. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
Well, it sounds like England has a hold on you, and I think it's a pretty rich imaginative vein. So I hope you, I'll be looking forward to your next series after the trilogy, which I intend to read. I really enjoyed talking to you. I love the book.
Thank you so much.
And I will recommend it to others, The Twilight of Avalon. It's a great novel of Tristan and Isolde from Anna Elliott. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. Bye-bye.